He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier.
Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our last episode interview with Brigadier General Joseph Ulatowski, Joe, who we've gotten to know pretty well. And certainly between our episodes, Rick and Joe and I have had lots of, I'm going to call it meaningful banter, but I don't know how meaningful it was. But certainly Joe is a cornucopia of, I bet you've never been described like this, Joe, a cornucopia of knowledge. How does that sound about military operations? And certainly, like we said, each one is unique, and you're your own unique cornucopia. Let's just call it that way. And today, what we're going to be talking about is Joe's fourth tour in the South Vietnamese, the war in Vietnam, but in Vietnam and in Cambodia, I think is, no? Yeah. Okay.
Southeast Asia.
So let's just call it Southeast Asia, yes. That's a thank you for correcting me on that. And at that time, you were charged with, this was after the war? Or was it still at the end, very end of the war? The end of the war was what, April 30th, 1975. But
no, it was just before the war ended.
Okay. And so tell me about your duties there and what you were doing.
Well, it was called the Joint Casualty Resolution Center. And our mission was to track down and find out all we could about people who were missing and listed as missing in action. And this went involved everyone who was shot down somewhere in Southeast Asia, crashed, who just disappeared for whatever reason and never was available to go home. It's the best way to phrase it.
Okay.
It was a very, I have to kind of describe the organization. We had two sides on it. One were some wonderful young special forces people who volunteered to go out into the jungles when they could do it, when officials let them do it or asked them to do it, unarmed, to try and search for remains of individuals who didn't make it back that we had some information about, to recover their bodies. It had a group of people who were from all services, who were analysts, who were collecting every bit, a possible bit of information about people who were missing in action. And it involved a central identification laboratory. When we did find something, who could do their best to identify who those remains belonged to. That was sort of the overall structure. It also involved North Vietnam, South Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and Thailand. And my interface with those people in the country usually had to be with the ambassadors or the ambassadorial staff, because they, as the war wound down and American troops got out, they would be the key contacts within the country. So we had to have an interrelationship with the embassies as well. Another interface that we had was, of course, with the families of these people that were the, it was quite a powerful political organization in the United States at the time, and who were interested in what the government was doing to recover their loved ones. And in many cases, for whatever their individual motives were, they didn't feel the government was doing enough. And they often had delegations coming over to visit me and demand more information.
And, you know, today being Armed Forces Day, and as we were talking before the interview, the church right across the street has a POW-MIA sign. And then, of course, there was also the movement in the United States, and people had the bracelets for a long time that had the name of MIA or POW.
Right.
And I suppose, talk about some of the reasons that people in, I mean, I'm sure that some, you know, people, families in the United States wanted to know if their relative there that was in the military, if they were alive or dead. You know, we always talk about closure. I don't know if there ever is closure. But talk about some of those reasons that people wanted to know.
Well, you had, again, you're dealing with people.
Right.
Everyone has a different motivation. You had some wives that, after a period of time, wanted to get remarried, so they would like to just collect the insurance, have the government declare them dead, and that's the end of it. Then you had others who wanted to stay married and kept hope up. Their love was overriding. And then you had parents who were just emotionally involved in it because they wanted to know what happened to their son. And it was a almost, you call a potpourri of emotions that just crossed the entire spectrum of emotion.
And I'm sure, you know, also we kind of put these two together, you know, MIA and POW, certainly wanted to know if the relative was dead or alive. And there was also, so it seemed to me there were so many, again, rumors about military that were, you know, kept for political reasons and were in camps and
yeah,
not
well,
released.
There were not only that, but there were quite a number of ambiguous cases. Let's say a man was shot down. Now,
okay,
he's flying a jet over North Vietnam or over South Vietnam. They're flying at 300-400 miles an hour. They're, in some cases, avoiding anti-aircraft fire, depending on where this is taking place. And a plane goes down. Well, a parachute comes out or it doesn't come out. If it doesn't come out or you didn't see it, that's all of this is ambiguous. You don't see it, so you don't know whether you report him where he went down. You're flying 400 miles an hour. You pick a, excuse me, my.
That's okay. I would assume, too, that in a situation where, you know, you said if a parachute is coming out or not coming out, if you're in a jet and you hit the ground at 400 miles an hour and you're still in that jet, there might be pieces of the plane or maybe an insignia or something on the plane.
Well, let me finish the.
Go ahead.
What I was saying. Either did you see it or did you not see it?
Right.
By the time you make a turn, come back. This is question number one. Number two, if he came out, is he okay? Was he captured or did he just hurt on the ground? If you start going through all these things, is the guy who saw him go out and saw where he thought he landed? It's hard from 2,000 or 3,000 feet going 400 miles an hour to be precise. Where the plane crashes or not is also imprecise. You're dealing with a very small map in a highly toxic environment. How accurate can you be? But you report the best you can. That then becomes part of the official file. And even if he gets out, did he survive or didn't he? In some cases, they paraded him, they parade people through town.
And we've all seen those pictures, yeah.
Yeah, we've seen pictures. And we know that he is a POW. We think he's a POW. When the time comes for accounting, and I went to North Vietnam to pick up 20 bodies, and it was a huge circus. They were treating us basically as you lost. And when I attempted to say, okay, I'm picking up 20 today, we've got 76 more people who have been reported in your custody. And they just said, that's not part of the discussion. If we talk anymore, you can't take the 20 back. I mean, we were in that position at that time. Then, so that was part of it. We had a very young analyst there who, in analyzing the records of, I don't remember the model of the aircraft, but there was a model aircraft that was over Hanoi, and they lost contact over Hanoi. And this young kid just said, lost contact, maybe it's just radio contact. And he started tracking radar station sightings that were unidentified all the way back into Thailand, where the plane was based, and tracked it to within, I don't remember, it's too far, too long ago, but within 20, 30 miles of the base, and found the plane in Thailand.
Wow.
You had people that are doing that sort of work. You would get people, villagers, you had a public relations program going where you were offering awards to people who, Vietnamese, were combat had been raging and was still under Vietnamese control, who would tell what, where they thought a body of an American was. You had people that would be out scavenging on helicopters that went down and that said, reported that they saw bones or something, remains in them. Now, this is could be years after after the helicopter was lost. You had charlatans that were trying to convince parents and loved ones that the government wasn't doing enough, but they, as private organizations, could be, if the parents would just contribute $100 or so to a fund, they'd go in and get them.
Wow.
You had all of these things.
That's pretty cruel.
It was terrible. But you had, there are going to be, if there's profit to be made, somebody's going to do it. And these were ex-military people who were coming back and trying to do that. It was just a rather busy time. And when all was said and done, and one of the big questions that we were dealing with was after the POWs were released and all of that, that there were still supposedly some left behind. And we had people interviewing and fingers out every place. If anybody came out of the North, refugees or anything like that, or for any reason, we could find any people who had been deliberately left behind or ignored in the process, and we never did. The search went on. Eventually some, and this was long after I left, eventually some people surfaced. They were, whether they were, I would say they were left behind, perhaps they volunteered to stay behind, but you had all sorts of these things. And mm-hmm. These were all kind of in the MIA category.
Or somebody maybe got off a base illegally at night or something. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Had those, too. You'd get some guys for whatever, some soldiers for whatever reason would crawl out from the barbed wire. And in some cases, some people crawled in behind them. And
yeah.
And you didn't know. You had a report of two people who were last seen smoking cigarettes in an ammunition dump when an explosion occurred.
Sure, yeah. And I'm sure that there, in many of the crashes and stuff, there really wasn't enough left to. I mean,
well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so, you had somebody got wounded in a battle. And battles go back and forth; they're not static. So you stay here. We'll bandage you up. We'll be back. And you don't know where you left them. We had cases like that. We had. So it's, there were all, there was, in one case, up by the city of Nha Trang, we had a report of a helicopter from farmers. Well, we sent people up there. We couldn't bring American my casualty resolution team or the whatever you search team. We couldn't bring them in Vietnam at the time because we couldn't live up to a guarantee that the ambassador had put on us, and that was you cannot bring a search team in until you can guarantee me that there will never be another American casualty here. Well,
how are you going to promise that? Yeah.
It took me 3 or 4 months to provide him the assurance that we would do everything that we could to keep that from happening, and for him to accept that we could do that with some degree of probability of living up to that requirement. It was a very political position where you're dealing with all of these various conflicting emotions, conflicting stories, conflicting
reasons, and
of different people, yeah, and yeah, different rules and regulations that people imposed on you. And yet it was a very, very rewarding one. And the people that were part of that group were very unusual. Now, I would cite one anecdote when I talked about charlatans. I had a very good relationship with the press. And one day, one of these reporters came in and said, "Joe, I want to let you know I'm going to do something here that's going to cause some severe problems for you guys in the Army and here in the casualty search group." I said, "What's that?" He said, "I've got reports here that some bodies have been located at such and such a point, and you guys won't go in there." I said, "Yeah." He said, "I'm going in there to pick them up." I said, "Okay, that's good. Let me give you a very short course on body recovery, and I'll support you any way I possibly can." He said, "Nope, no support. I've put together my own team, a private security group, and I'm going in there and pick them up." And so I said, "Okay." I gave him the body bags and everything, short course. And he went in, and next morning he dumped 4 body bags there outside the door of my office, not my office, but my people. And this was in Vietnam. I was based in Thailand. That's where he came and told me. So he came in and told me, gave me the story. And I said, "Wait a minute, why don't you take this to the end where the body bags are going down to my central identification lab and just see how this whole thing plays out?" Well, he agreed to do that, and he said the publicity in the United States would be bad for the military, so I was trying to give a complete story rather than a partial story. We had a couple of monkeys, the Central Identification Lab. We had a couple of monkeys and a couple of Vietnamese and some weapons that had been given to the Vietnamese earlier in the conflict. Numbers, serial numbers were traced, and got all of that. So then he said, oh, I put together this operation. I went in there, and this is all I have. Two monkeys, two Vietnamese, and a couple of weapons.
And so he got taken.
He got taken.
Wow.
And that's the story that eventually ran.
Mm-hmm.
So it was some similar story. I mean, what actually came out, I don't know, but I didn't see. But I know that it came out. He was pretty darn accurate in what he said.
Yeah, interesting that. I also talked to another guy who said that, you know, if they sometimes they were out in the field and they were so nervous and reactive to virtually anything, any movement, anything out there, and they would, after it got light and they would go out, it found out that they had killed a number of monkeys, you know, that had been...
Yeah, that's true, too.
You know, that had been out there, and so you think you have some of that action, and you don't.
Yeah.
And but it sounds like that there are just so many reasons, and I'm assuming, I shouldn't assume at all, but do you think right now, in kind of in closing here, that anything that would have come out of Vietnam and, you know, prisoners and MIA, that we know everything that is possible to know right now? Or do you think some of that's still secret?
No, you still have people working. And you have people, North Vietnam has agreed to search people going in, following up on any of these reports that they claim they don't know anything about. But if we think it's there, why, they've got some of these young folks who worked for me that are still working for the Central Identification Lab and in North Vietnam, as well as in all of Vietnam. So, yes, the search goes on, and a lot of the emotion has died down, but there are still those people who have some sort of hope for some sort of closure.
Right.
And I guess that was one of the more difficult parts when I was dealing with those MIAs, that the MIA issue with the families who were so deeply hoping for closure.
Right.
And right. So, yes, yeah, they have my sympathy even today.
Yeah, and I would also echo that and say that's a good place to know and to close, is that we just simply don't know everything.
Yep.
And thank you, Joe, for being with us today. And
it's my pleasure.
It has been a pleasure, and thank you. Goodbye, I almost blew that. Nice to have you with us here on Voice of Vashon. Thank you very much.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years.